The headlines: Israeli occupation forces continue their attacks on Al-Shifa Medical Complex in Gaza, killing dozens of civilians. Leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says international massacres, the intentional massacre of Palestinians, prove the true nature of Israel. And Iran strongly condemns Israel's attacks on Syria as unlawful and provocative. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Nearly 6 months into the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza, the regime's relentless bombardment and shelling continue to claim innocent lives in the besieged territory. The Gaza Health Ministry says over 100 Palestinians lost their lives in Israeli strikes in a matter of 24 hours. Several areas, including Jabalia in the north and Rafah in the south, have come under aerial strike. The death toll from U.S.-backed genocide in Gaza since October 7th is now almost 32,000, most of them women and children. 7,000 more are unaccounted for and feared to be dead under the rubble of their homes. Over 74,000 Gazans have also been injured. The Palestinian Media Office in Gaza has accused Israel of deliberately killing over dozens of patients in Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital over the past 4 days, according to the statement. To the Palestinian, passed away because they have deprived the medicine while the regime forces have cut off water and electricity to the complex. It said dozens of nurses, doctors, and hospital staff have also been abducted by the Israeli regime. The media office condemned the crimes committed by Israel as well as Washington's support for Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has warned that the attacks against Al-Shifa Hospital have made it impossible for agencies to distribute aid. It has also expressed concern about reports of medical staff being detained. Al-Shifa, the largest hospital in Gaza, has been under direct Israeli attacks, raids, and airstrikes since Monday. Our correspondent in Gaza, Muti Abu Musabi, has talked to some of them. Let's take a listen.
Israeli aggression is still persistent against the Al-Shifa Medical Complex and even the surrounding areas of Gaza Strip. As you know, that today is the fourth consecutive day of this brutal aggression. As a result, the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped hundreds of the Palestinian civilians from inside the Al-Shifa Medical Complex, including paramedics and journalists and even civilians of those evacuees who were taking shelter inside the hospital. Actually, according to the latest news from the Al-Shifa Medical Complex, that at least 3 Palestinian patients passed away over the lack of the needed medical care after the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped and abducted the paramedics from the Al-Shifa Medical Complex. While in the surrounding areas, the Israeli occupation forces are still attacking the residential buildings. Fierce air strikes hit the residential buildings over the last couple of hours as the Israeli air strikes targeted and destroyed several residential buildings. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery and the Israeli tanks also maintained shelling the residential apartments in the vicinity of the Shifa Medical Complex. A big fire blazed and engulfed a lot of the Palestinian residential apartments in the area, in the vicinity of the Shifa Medical Complex. We are talking about continuous Israeli airstrikes, and the humanitarian conditions are still catastrophic by all means for the Palestinian evacuees who are still stranded and besieged inside the Shifa Medical Complex, or for those who are still located and trapped under the heavy bombardments of the Israeli tanks and the Israeli airstrikes in the vicinity of the Shifa Medical Complex. Many appeals actually were released by the Palestinian families in order to help them, I mean, for the Red Cross area and the human rights organizations to help them to safeguard, to be safeguarded and to leave the area, because the Israeli shelling is fierce and intense, and it hasn't stopped for a while. We are talking about 4 consecutive months of those continuous Israeli strikes and attacks.
Moving on, the United Nations Satellite Center has released an updated assessment of the damage inflicted on the besieged Gaza Strip. It says 35% of all buildings in Gaza have been damaged. It also said that nearly 90,000 homes of the Palestinians have also been destroyed. Around 32,000 have been completely destroyed. The new assessment shows that nearly 20,000 buildings have been damaged in Gaza since the previous assessment in January. Israel's indiscriminate bombing of the besieged territory have resulted in the destruction of hospitals, schools, churches, and civilians' infrastructure. Such destruction of homes and other essential areas has displaced hundreds of thousands of people. Hundreds of human rights organizations say that the destruction appears to be aimed at or to have an effect on rendering a return to civilians in these areas. The United States has already vetoed all the UN Security Council resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire in the war-ravaged Gaza Strip. Now faced with increasing international backlash, its Secretary of State claims that his country is working on with Qatar and Egypt on a ceasefire proposal.
We've been working, as you know, with Egypt, with Qatar, and with Israel to put a strong proposal on the table. Hamas responded to that. The negotiators continue to work. The gaps are narrowing, and we're continuing to push for an agreement in Doha. There's still difficult work to get there, but I continue to believe it's possible.
Biden added that the proposal calls for an immediate ceasefire to pave the way for the release of hostages and get more humanitarian aid into the territory. He was speaking after meetings with a number of Arab foreign ministers in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Blinken will arrive in Israel on Friday as part of his latest West Asia tour. As Israel's main backer, the U.S. has been supporting the regime both financially and militarily since the beginning of its genocide in Gaza. The U.S. resolution will put to vote at the Security Council on Friday. And leaders of 27 European Union countries have called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip to create sustainable ceasefire. The EU leaders made the request in a statement after a meeting of European Council in Brussels. They also urged Israel not to launch its planned ground of operation in Rafah, saying that it would worsen the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in the Strip. They added that the Rafah offensive would also prevent the provisions of basic services and humanitarian assistance to civilians. EU leaders expressed deep concern about the catastrophic situation of children in Gaza and the imminent risk of famine caused by insufficient entry of aid. They called for full, rapid, and unhindered human rights access into Gaza. Now, we are joined by Thea West, a geopolitical analyst, who is joining us from Dallas, Texas. So, Mr. West, in your opinion, how truthful is the U.S. this time around, having vetoed all the ceasefire resolutions so far? What do you think would be the fate of this new one?
Well, the United States, under President Joe Biden, they're not serious about Israel, because if they were serious, they would not be providing them with money, with weaponry, also with military intelligence with which to attack the Palestinians in Gaza. And of course, they would not be vetoing everything in the United Nations Security Council that is geared towards ending this situation in Gaza, which is a situation of mass genocide. Now, many of Netanyahu's people here in the United States, as well as in Israel, they are claiming that there is no moral equivalency. Okay? In other words, what they're saying is that we can harm, we can kill as many Palestinians as we want because of what happened on October the 7th. Now, when the United States says or is talking about a ceasefire, well, Benjamin Netanyahu is saying, we're going to continue to attack Rafah. We're going to send boots on the ground into Rafah. So then you have the European Union. Well, before the European Union, you had a conversation, a meeting with between the Chancellor of Germany and Netanyahu there in Israel. The German Chancellor, Scholz, he got Netanyahu to commit to not going into Rafah with boots on the ground, the military going into Rafah. However, Joe Biden was not able to get Netanyahu to not do that. He was not able to get Netanyahu to promise that he would not do that. Now, I have to say this. Germany is the biggest trade partner of Israel. Germany also provides, gives, not sell, but gives its nuclear war submarines to Israel. So that is an indication that Germany has some leverage with Netanyahu. Now, it would be good if this ceasefire eventually comes into play. I don't have any high hopes that it will, but it would be good if it did come into play. In fact, the United States, Joe Biden indicated that they're going to pay, you know, like over $1 billion to build a pier on the Mediterranean in the Rafah area where the Palestinians can come and get food and other essentials. Now, this is absurd. It should not have to be done. But this is it's an example of the type of grip that Netanyahu and his group of people have upon the American government. And that is not good. It's not good at all. So I personally don't hold out too much hope for a ceasefire of any relevancy, because Netanyahu's goal is to eliminate as many Palestinians, regardless if they're women or children, as he can. And he's trying to do that. He's trying to run out the clock doing that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Arthia West, geopolitical analyst, joining us from Texas. A leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement has strongly condemned the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza as purposeful, intentional, and pre-planned. Speaking in a televised address, Abdul Malik al-Houthi said a massacre of Palestinians by the regime's forces attests to the criminal nature of the Zionists. He added that what is happening in Gaza shows that Zionists are a threat to the entire humanity. Al-Houthi also stressed that while Israel uses hunger as a weapon against Gazans, the U.S. has claimed that there is no evidence to prove that. He also said that the ongoing genocide in Gaza shows more decline of the U.S. and serves as a warning regarding the threat it poses to other nations. Al-Houthi affirmed that Israel has failed to achieve any of its goals on the ground despite all of its heinous crimes, touching upon the recent developments in the Gaza Strip. And Al-Houthi said that the U.S. and the U.K. have not only failed to protect Israeli-linked ships, but they have also failed to protect their own vessels. He said that they are now resorting to camouflage tactics to conceal their ships, but their vessels have been detected by Yemeni naval forces. And Yemeni activist and political commentator Hossein al-Bukhaiti joined us earlier. He said Israel has been taken off guard by Yemen's pro-Palestine questions against the occupying regime.
Of course, the Yemeni attack against Israel, it came to a surprise. They did not actually expect that Yemenis who has been actually under a blockade and siege from the United States and Saudi Arabia and as well United Arab Emirates, who have been under attack, more than 250,000 Saudi airstrike and attack has been conducted against Yemeni. They have destroyed Yemeni economic infrastructure, health infrastructure, and under this blockade, they were really, really surprised that Yemeni actually has the one who have declared clearly the war against Israel by targeting Israeli army bases in south of occupied Palestine, and as well the next step was to block the ship, and this actually have a direct effect on Israel. We have seen that the latest report from Eilat, that they say the Eilat airport, Eilat port has lost about 80-90% of its capacity, so it's almost kind of closed. Even Eilat city has been affected, shops there and companies and factories has been deeply and strongly affected by those attack from Yemen and by the blockade. That's why they actually have tried now to avoid those attack by either camouflage for their ship and as well by going through around the around the South Africa. But Yemeni actually is always, they will expand its attack to target Israeli ship either in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden and as well in the Indian Ocean.
And Iran has strongly condemned Israel's frequent attacks on Syria as unlawful and provocative, saying that the regime's strikes only escalate regional tensions and undermine stability. Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations was addressing a Security Council meeting on the situation of Syria. Amir Saeed Iravani added that the Israeli regime must be held accountable and forced to end such aggressive actions immediately. He also called for an immediate lifting of unilateral sanctions imposed on Damascus. Iravani said unilateral sanctions violate the basic human rights of Syrian people and punishes the entire Syrian population. He added that Iran believes that the Syrian crisis can only be resolved through political means and will continue supporting its government's efforts to restore the country's unity and territorial integrity. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Congratulations to everyone. Congratulations to everyone.
Alongside Iranians in Nowruz. In the name of God, Salam everybody, welcome to the program. Today is the second day of Nowruz holidays. Congratulations on this ancient Iranian feast. As we had promised yesterday, today we will speak about the customs of different ethnicities in Iran in Nowruz. Today we will speak about the customs of people in Mazandaran and Golestan provinces. Stay with us, please. Mazani and Katuli ethnicities are the most groups living in the north and northeast of Iran. They have very similar customs and traditions, though their dialects may sound somehow different. Nowruz Khan is the person who goes from street to street and neighborhood to neighborhood to give the news of coming of spring a few weeks before Nowruz. What he does is called Nowruz Khani, literally meaning reciting and singing on Nowruz. Nowruz Khans in Mazandaran start their job in Esfand, the last month of the Iranian calendar year. Carrying a stick and a backpack, they walk in the alleys and streets of their city and sing melodies in their Mazani dialect containing good news of arrival of spring. Local people serve them with sweets and pastries. This custom has been held mostly in villages for the recent years. According to historical accounts, Nowruz Khani dates back to pre-Islam era. Nowruz Khani among Katul people of Golestan province is also interesting. Katuli ethnicity sing Nowruz Khani with setar instrument, and sometimes people accompany the singer. Singers wish a good and happy year for people and pray for the remedy of the sick. Another beautiful custom among people in Mazandaran in Nowruz is to determine luck for the new year. It means the first person who enters the house will be good-footed. In some regions of Mazandaran province, the custom is called Madarm. According to this traditional custom, a few minutes before the turn of the year, a person who is accepted among all members of the family stands at the threshold with a tray containing a copy of the Noble Quran, a bowl of water, and green sprouts. He waits for the moment of turn of the year. He's the first person who steps in the house. He sprinkles water on the threshold or corner of the house, and other members of family put a gift in the tray. Choosing luck for the new year differs from region to region. According to an old belief, a good luck will bring a good year for the house. Sometimes a person is the luck of several houses. Thus, families wait till his turn for their house. Another custom among the people of Mazandaran and Golestan provinces is venerating of the dead on the last Thursday of year. Like many people across the country, they go to the graveyards and recite Quran and distribute sweets, halwa, and other edibles, hoping to attract God's mercy for their dead ones. This day is known as Alfe in the region. According to the Islamic narrations, the dead expect gifts from their families. Thus, when their siblings, parents, or other relatives recite verses of the Quran, especially chapter Hamd, for them, the spirits of the dead will benefit from it. We have also been recommended to recite Salawat, greetings to the Prophet and his progeny, and send its reward to the spirit of the dead. In many villages, the custom of Alfe is held in the traditional form. The hosts clean their houses and try to forget spites and grudges. They fumigate wild rue and distribute edibles as votive for guests. Wild rue is believed to ward off bad luck. They also keep a light or lantern burning outdoors, believing that the spirits of the dead will find a way to the house easier. The relatives of the dead spread a tablecloth over the grave and put various kinds of edibles on it as votive. This old custom remains to date with some changes. Thank you. Now let us become familiar with some of the foods in Mazandaran and Golestan for Nowruz. The people of Katul have baked a special kind of bread called Bibi Nowruz since old times. It was more popular in mountainous regions. The people of Katul used to bake big breads as many as the men of the family. This was Bibi Nowruz and would be consumed till the end of Nowruz. Then, on the 13th day, that is Sizde Bedar, they would go to the plains and gardens and eat what had remained from the breads. If they couldn't finish all breads, they would pour the rest in a river or leave it for animals to eat. This was considered as a gift to the nature. Well, let's see what pastries or candies are made in Mazandaran and Golestan provinces for Nowruz. Walnut halwa is a kind of pastry which is made in Mazandaran for Nowruz. It is called aguza halwa in some cities. It is made from walnut, rice, sugar and oil. Halwa is prepared for both feast and mourning in the north of Iran. Pusht zik is another pastry made in Mazandaran. It contains sesame and sugar. It is very tasty. Now, dear listeners, in the next episode, we will become familiar with the customs of Nowruz in Gilan province. God bless you and goodbye.
Iranian weapon. Part 3.
Iran has long been trying to buy a Russian system called the S-300. Tehran has already purchased a sort of the export version of the system. This system is called Tor M1 or Psalm 15. The range of the missiles and radar of this system is short and suitable for hitting cruise missiles and drones at low altitudes. Therefore, the S-300 can undo the knots of the Iranian defense dome. Tor means dominance. The Russian system has a lot of operational capability at very low to medium altitudes, but may be captured in enemy cyber operations. These 300s should reach Iran, but the same system gets stuck in the net of sanctions, and their delivery to Iran has made headlines for quite a while. The position of the Islamic Republic is standing against any aggression and humiliation. Delay in delivery of the S-300 prompts Iran to start developing a similar air defense system. It's a bold claim, but Iran has previously reverse-engineered American systems, so it isn't unlikely to reach this one as well. Meanwhile, the project to design an Iranian S-300 system had started, and on the other hand, the complaint against the Russians had yielded good results, and the first convoy of S-300s was arriving in Iran. After all, the S-300 is finally arriving in Iran. Iran has gained significant expertise in reverse engineering defense technology and is now moving toward designing a new system based on a combination of Western and Eastern technologies. Iran has many natural specifications, which are why it needs diverse air defense systems. The combination of these systems is called DOME. The Iranian dome covers everywhere in the country, including the mountains and even the seas. With the launch of the new military satellite, there is hope that Iran will be able to monitor its land from space. However, until that day comes, there are still several wonders left for the Americans. First, at the beginning of the 2010s, here at the Kandahar Air Base, belonging to the U.S. occupying forces in Afghanistan. In the early 2010s, Iran was no longer like Iraq, where by destroying limited radar stations, one could blind the eyes. This was a lesson that Iran's air defense gave to the Americans in December of 2011. This aircraft that takes off the ground will leave a different mark in the history of Iran-U.S. relations. The aircraft utilizes the cutting-edge military technology in the world, the Beast of Kandahar, or the RQ-170. It's an aircraft with the highest level of stealth. The RQ flies into Iranian airspace. The RQ pilots are certain that no one is able to see them on its radar. No Iranian air defense had locked on RQ. Everything is like the F-117s that flew over Iraq. The American side is completely relaxed, but the Americans are wrong. Not only the radar see the RQ, but even the flight image of the aircraft can be seen live in the Iranian operations room. A few minutes later, the RQ connection with the Kandahar Center is cut off. The Americans are still confused as to what happened to their strategic UAV, and images are broadcast on Iranian TV. The RQ is safe and sound on the ground and now in control of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps personnel. The footage is amazing. Has Iran reached a level of technology that can not only see or destroy the most important espionage aircraft in the world, but also land it safely on the ground? The news is true. So true that the U.S. president confirms it in front of the cameras in amazement. Iran gives the answer to the U.S. side a year later in this place, when the leader of the revolution sits in front of the American UAV and the Iranian version of the RQ-170. Seymour is an Iranian model of the RQ-170 that takes off the ground. Some time later, Seymour makes its first operational cross-border flight here, striking the Daesh headquarters near the U.S. military base. This is not a simple event. In this way, the Seymour flies from Iran in the middle of the night and strikes the strategic depth of Daesh in such a way that the U.S. defenses did not show the slightest reaction. The Iranian Seymour was hidden from the U.S. defenses, and this by no means is something irrelevant. An important achievement has been made in this dark night. However, Iran's air defense system has just begun its job. The Iranian skies are no longer safe for spy aircraft. August 2014, Isfahan Province. This fragmented aircraft is the Israeli regime's most important spy aircraft, Hermes. The legendary name shows that the Israeli UAV is very smart, intelligent, and untraceable, of course, until before this scene. Thank you. This is the same Hermes that had been unveiled with this shape and image. In an ugly and inhuman act, Israel used civilian airliners as a shield for Hermes. Firing any missiles towards Hermes could have caused the downing of a passenger plane, and this alone would have been a means of media war against Iran. The Israelis never admitted that they hid their espionage UAV in the airway routes. Therefore, the detection and targeting process of the espionage UAV took roughly 40 minutes and finally was destroyed over the city of Natanz. The fact that the Iranian radars detected the not-so-large Israeli drones among all the passenger planes is just one side of the story. But the fact that the Iranian missiles were able to distinguish the super-stealth UAV from the other planes without mistake and destroy it is another story. It means Iran has reached a high level in air defense. This preparedness is a product of these drills. This is Semnon in 2018. The Iranian army is in war drills, and the cameras catch a glimpse of a special radar and air defense system. This system is called Mersad. But the type of its missile remains unknown, and no information about them was published until the end of the 2000s. Drone power and defense power. Images are displaying only the power of one of the combat units of the Iranian army. Not all of Iran's armed forces. That was in 2018, that is, only 30 years after the final year of Iraq's war on Iran and when Iran had a lot of problems defending its own skies. A year later, the Semnon Desert again. The Mersad 16 system is supposed to be tested here. The Mersad 16. Not every country can manufacture this. The Iranian Hafiz radar is highly capable and has brought Iran to a point where it can cover up to 250 kilometers. Hafiz simultaneously engages and tracks 100 targets. This is how Hafiz was tested next to Mersad 16.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, it is such an honor to be here. So we are talking about the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. So of course, you know, there are so many different and beautiful benefits of the holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle and for our Islamic lifestyle. You know, as we have said in some of our programs, you know, the holy month of Ramadan is this training period or this renewal for us to be able to once again connect with our Islamic lifestyle. So all of the things that throughout the year we kind of tend to forget to do, in the holy month of Ramadan, we are reminded and kind of retrained and, you know, re-energized to go ahead and continue that ideal Islamic lifestyle that we're all trying to achieve. So whether it's connecting with the Almighty Allah or focusing on our prayers, focusing on du'as, you know, trying to keep a healthy lifestyle, Islamic lifestyle when it comes to eating, our eating habits and, you know, junk food and sodas and cola drinks and, you know, all of these different things that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan. So what are some of the benefits, right? In a previous program, we had talked about how when we don't understand the benefits or we don't understand the importance or we don't understand the essence of the holy month of Ramadan, then our excitement level, our cheerful level, our I love Ramadan level starts to dip a little bit and it gets quite low at some times. So, well, we decided, well, you know, in the very following program, why not tell you some of these benefits of the holy month of Ramadan so that, you know, our cheerful level and our I love Ramadan level goes up, you know, and we are really able to appreciate this holy month. And when we appreciate the holy month, then we are going to be able to really take advantage and benefit from the holy month of Ramadan.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan and how this is an excellent opportunity for us to be able to, you know, take so many benefits from this beautiful month. Yes, it's difficult. It's full of trials and difficulties and, you know, it's hard and staying hungry, staying thirsty. It puts a lot of spiritual pressure on us and physical pressure as well. But there are so many benefits to this holy month of Ramadan. And perhaps, you know, we can say that it is because of these spiritual and physical pressures that are upon us, because of these trials and difficulties and because of its hardship. These are some of the reasons why the holy month of Ramadan is so valuable in the eyes of Allah, the Almighty, right? And we all have tests in our lives. And when we successfully pass those tests by the grace of the Almighty Allah, you know, of course, our spiritual rank increases and etc. But it's kind of a side note. When we're talking about the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan, of course, this is a month in which we can connect with the Almighty Allah all that much easier, right? And that is probably one of the greatest benefits of the holy month of Ramadan. We are able to make this connection with the Almighty Allah. And, you know, you might wonder, well, what's so important and beneficial about that? Well, that connection with the Almighty Allah is what keeps you pure, It keeps you tranquil. It gives you peace of mind. It gives you peace of soul. It gives you serenity. It gives you calm. It also reduces our stress, our anxiety about the past or the future or the present. You know, it gets rid of so much depression and sadness. So really, you know, the most, probably the best and the greatest benefit of the holy month of Ramadan is this connection with the Almighty Allah. And of course, there's a long list, which I would humbly request that all of our listeners, why don't you go ahead and write down some of the things off the top of your head, which you think are the benefits of the holy month of Ramadan, which we can continue in the rest of the year in our Islamic lifestyle. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya Habib, Ramadan.
Tonight on Exposé, Western broadcast media's narrative of the March 1st parliamentary elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran revolved around made-up stories about Iranians abstained from voting in protest against their government. Meanwhile, the majority of opinion pieces written by prominent Western mainstream media refuse to accept that Iran is a democratic state, bringing nothing new to their reporting tone and essentially rehashing old tales and narratives. And the famine brought on by the ongoing Zionist-Israeli genocide in Gaza, as well as the airdrop charade of aid and expired food on Gaza residents, was another hot topic last week, particularly on social media. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Hundreds of headlines preceding and following the parliamentary elections in Iran were portrayed on major Western news outlets, but irony rested in relying on the opinion of just one or two citizens to adopt broad front-page headlines talking about the absence of democracy in Iran. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert and writer at The Cradle, more about it in Fake News Exposé. The electoral battle for the new parliament and the assembly of experts in Iran, which took place at the beginning of March, revolved around the younger generation of conservatives who succeeded in tipping the scales in many electoral districts, a fact that did not go down well with Western media. Here is more about this with our broadcast expert, Fuad Itayim. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having
Fuad, to talk about this. What do you have for us about this?
So Western broadcast media has addressed the 2024 parliamentary elections in Iran. And the main message that was propagated by most of these outlets was that somehow the Iranian people stayed away from the ballot in protest against the government.
Okay.
So let's start with the British media outlet Channel 4, who sent its lead presenter, Krishnan Guru Murthy, to cover the news of the 2024 elections in Iran. Mm-hmm. And he decided to basically not focus at all on the issue of the election and resort back to the same old Western media narrative that mm-hmm. rights are crushed in Iran.
Welcome to Tehran. In 2 days' time, Iranians will vote to renew their parliament in a key test for the country's regime. The test being how many people will show up to the polls, and not necessarily who will win. They are the first elections since mass protests broke out 2 years ago following the death of a young woman, Mahsa Amini, under suspicious circumstances after she was arrested for not wearing a hijab.
So Krishnan decides to open with the story of the late young Mahsa Amini, who died in September 2022. And according to coronary examinations after her death, Mahsa Amini died from cerebral hypoxia, basically disproving the claims that she was killed by security forces. Despite this fact, he maintains that she died under suspicious circumstances. Typical Western propaganda.
And he opens with it about a feature report about Iranian elections. So this has nothing even to do with the protests that happened years ago.
So making it worse, Krishnan then finds a young non-hijabi woman on the streets of Tehran, hoping that she's going to tell him that the police have been harassing her, beating her, threatening her. And the answer he gets is disappointing.
Do you mind me asking, I mean, you're not covering your head. Do you feel worried about being out when you're not covered?
No.
Nobody's ever given me any trouble. No one has.
Is that normal in Tehran? Everywhere in Tehran? Or is it just here?
No.
I haven't had trouble anywhere.
I don't think he liked what she said, did he?
Not so much. He seems quite unsatisfied with the answer. So what he does now is he moves on to a group of other ladies who they say oppose the policies of the Iranian government. Instead of taking advantage of the situation and asking them in more detail why they're opposed to the government, why they'd like to sit out the current election, he decides to ask them about the genocide in Gaza.
The other thing we're asking people about is the situation in Gaza. So do you think the people feel the same way as the government when it comes to regional politics?
No.
Are you kidding with me?
Iranian people like peace. Yes. They want to live in peace.
Yeah.
If you look at our history, all of the time they wanted to be in peace. But the government is the opposite of that.
I don't know how this relates to the Iranian election, which were, by the way, won in majority by the conservative side. But it seems that Krishnan failed to find what he was looking for on the streets of Tehran, which is widespread anti-government sentiment. That seems to be what he thinks he's going to find. So he decides to ask about the situation in Gaza and resorts to the idea that Iranians don't care about the Palestinian struggle and only want peace. So his question is about Gaza. So what peace exactly is he referring to? Peace with Israel, the illegal occupying state whose flag is painted on the streets of
Tehran. Basically, people just stomp on while walking. And,
so
we're talking about the same state that has openly supported resistance against Zionist Israel for the past at least four decades. So I think that question was some sort of a question that he wanted to get out of the people's minds, where they do not support any resistance in the region. But I mean,
100%. And he's asking a few people on the street instead of carrying out a widespread survey.
It's while obvious. Talking about an election that the opposition lost.
Exactly. 100%. So another mainstream outlet that propagated fake news and lies was CBS News.
So no surprise there whatsoever.
Definitely not. So CBS News got a hold of Karim Sajjadpour, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Now, Karim, an American-born Iranian who studied at Johns Hopkins and resides in the United States, here makes sure to spew as much hatred as possible against the Islamic Republic without any facts to back up his claims. Let's hear what he had to say.
It's good to see you again. This was the first parliamentary election in Iran since the sustained mass protests over the death of Mahsa Amini. Does the turnout tell you anything?
It's another reminder, John, that Iranians know they're living under a religious dictatorship that can't be reformed via the ballot box. I think what's particularly insulting for Iranians is that, you know, all politicians lie everywhere, but when you're being ruled by a religious government that rules from a moral pedestal and engages in this level of corruption and repression, I think it's even more insulting than just being ruled by a run-of-the-mill corrupt dictatorship.
We have enough trouble believing polls here in the United States, so I hesitate to put so much or read too much into those opinions expressed in that poll. But do the findings square with your understanding about public sentiment in the greater population of Iran?
Definitely. I think everyone who has been following Iran for a while or has visited the country as noted these popular sentiments for many years now, that, you know, after 4.5 decades of living under religious government, people want to separate mosque and state.
So it's quite audacious claiming that people live in a religious dictatorship in Iran and that the people somehow want to separate mosque and state, even though the entire country revolted against an actual dictatorship in 1979, a dictatorship that was secular and backed by America and Israel and suppressed the rights of the entire population. Mm-hmm. Also, none of the figures that he's using are based on any of the recent election results.
Mm-hmm. I don't know where he's getting the facts from. I mean, these analysts that go on Western media, especially broadcast media, who are supposedly American-born Iranians, but either have never visited Iran or they visit Iran to see family and then return. They don't even conduct any kind of surveys or try to get data from the people, from the public. The least that they could do, ask the communities that they visit and then go on TV and say things like this, claiming that if you are a religious state, then you are a dictatorship. I mean, that literally applies to 70% of the states around the world, and that still is not the fact, not the real story about Iran. But anyways, I want to thank you very much, Fuad, for explaining to us how the broadcast media was basically spewing all these lies about the elections in Iran. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to digital mainstream media. It wasn't easy for Western mainstream media to accept a contrasting scene to what they had been promoting in the days leading up to the parliamentary elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran. Most of the opinion pieces published by major Western news outlets were struck by the public choice in Iran that they practically recycled the same old stories and repeated the same old narrative when it comes to their regime's disapproval of democracy in Iran. Julia Qasim, our mainstream media expert, joins us to tell us more about it. The floor is all yours, Julia.
Thanks, Marwa. So despite the massive Western campaign to against Iran to basically boycott the elections for the Islamic Consultative Assembly and the Assembly of Experts, citizens participated enthusiastically with noticeable lines at the polling stations continuing on until the very last moments of the 1st of March. Mm-hmm. So, however, the New York Times continued to spread lies by claiming that many ordinary Iranians were fed up with the faltering economy and the so-called government's oppressive rules and violent crackdowns on peaceful protests, instead of reporting the reality mm-hmm. on the real reasons behind the economic hardships inside Iran, represented by the aggressive U.S. and EU sanctions mm-hmm. illegally imposed on the Iranian people. So in a piece published on March 1st, 2024, written by Farnaz Farsihi and Leili Nirokazar, entitled "Many Iranians Boycott Vote Despite Officials' Pleas and Roses at Polls," the New York Times claimed that the residents across a range of locations, big cities like Tehran, Isfahan, and Shiraz, and smaller ones like Sari and Lahijan, said in interviews that polling stations in their neighborhoods were mostly empty and only the most loyal supporters of the government had shown up to vote, with many other Iranians choosing not to even leave their homes. Mm-hmm. But in reality, Marwa, a small search on the same cities mentioned in this article, and you can see that they lied about the turnout, especially in the capital Tehran and mm-hmm. Shiraz and Isfahan. So the New York Times piece was less chaotic than the foreign policy one published on February 29, 2024, just one day before Election Day. The first suspicious part of this piece, writers themselves, where we have no evidence whatsoever if they were even Iranian or not.
Wow.
As the foreign policy claims they were, Saki Nasiri, a pseudonym of a journalist in Iran, and Tuba Moshiri, another pseudonym of a journalist in Iran, who wrote an article titled "Iran's New, Even Worse Hijab Era Has Begun."
Wow.
So the foreign policy here falsely claims that freedoms are increasingly under threat for Iran's female citizens, according to women's rights advocates and United Nations experts, who say that the hijab crackdown is creating a chilling effect on women's rights activism and legitimizing broader gender discrimination. Mind you, these women's rights advocates and UN experts have no names and no positions, which puts such claims at the level of heresy. Mm-hmm. This piece by Foreign Policy continues to spread lies, claiming that Iranian women now cannot drive, cannot do their jobs, and can't even have coffee without worrying about having their cars impounded, being fired, or getting hit with fines if the hijab is not worn or worn too loosely. Yet in reality, if you go on YouTube and research these claims, look at the malls in Tehran, look at the streets of Tehran, mm-hmm. you can instantly see that these statements are completely false and that they're nothing but fake.